educational programming. The program focuses on young people 12 to 18 for nonviolent offenses. Often it's substance use. The program instills in the young people that they're valued members of the community. Leah Hitcher is Healing to Wellness Court coordinator.
They see all these people and they think that their intentions is just to detain them and put them away. They're bad kids. But when they get to see in our court team and everybody weigh in and say good positive things about them too, they have hope in us.
The Healing to Wellness Court was started in 2021. The first referrals were taken in 2023, and in the spring of 2024, the program saw its first graduate. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. A new book being released by Medicine Wheel Publishing marks Orange Shirt Day, which raises awareness about residential schools in Canada. The book, Today is Orange Shirt Day by Phyllis Webstad, is designed for young children up to 3 years old. The author and publisher say the book provides a gentle way to introduce the next generation to learn about the history and legacy of residential schools. The book will be released on August 20th ahead of the holiday in September.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 25th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ken Jones, Mel Gertoff, Roz Brown, Eric Tegadoff, and Mark Moran. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. So glad you're with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertoff. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. The war in Ukraine, no way out. Who will be France's prime minister? And the two-state solution in the Middle East may be dead. The war in Ukraine, no way out. People involved in conflict resolution often say that every war must end. Most wars do end in some fashion, but plenty of wars, and the war in Ukraine appears to be one of them, drag on indefinitely with no prospect for a ceasefire, much less a peace settlement. These intractable conflicts most often are civil wars in which the losing side never accepts defeat, even if it agrees to put down its arms and, as sometimes happens, joins the winning side in a power-sharing arrangement. In the Ukraine war, neither party is anywhere near accepting either defeat or a stalemate. Governments that try or pretend to be peacemakers mouth right-sounding words, but act with opposite intent. As one recent example, consider what India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi had to say at the conclusion of a two-day meeting with Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Modi appealed for peace in the Ukraine war, saying, quote, India has always called for respecting the UN Charter, including territorial integrity and sovereignty. There is no solution on the battlefield. Dialogue and diplomacy are the way forward, unquote. Yet India is a major buyer of Russian oil, has never accused Russia of aggression, and does not honor the International Criminal Court's indictments of Putin and other senior Russian officials for war crimes. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky noted the bear hug when Putin and Modi greeted one another. Zelensky said, quote, "It is a huge disappointment and a devastating blow to peace efforts to see the leader of the world's largest democracy hug the world's most bloody criminal in Moscow on such a day." Then there's Hungary and China. Viktor Orban recently paid his ninth visit to China in the last 15 years. He and Xi Jinping patted each other's back for promoting peace in the war in Ukraine. Orban, like Xi, has towed the Russian line, urging Ukraine to stop fighting, accept a ceasefire, and then start talking with Moscow. The Chinese readout of the meeting says, quote, "Xi expressed appreciation for Orban's efforts in promoting the political settlement of the Ukraine crisis." However, such efforts have in fact gone nowhere. Xi then called for an early ceasefire, which is nowhere in sight, and said, quote, "The priority is to cool down the situation by observing the three principles of no expansion of the battlefield, no escalation of fighting, and no fanning by any party of the flames," unquote. Actually, Russia has violated all three of those principles, yet that went unmentioned. Another huge obstacle to peace in Ukraine is the day-after problem. What will the country look like after years of intense Russian bombing and town-by-town fighting? Who will pay for Ukraine's physical rehabilitation, estimated in the hundreds of billions of dollars? And what if Russia wins? Carl Bildt, Sweden's former prime minister and foreign minister, wrote in answer to that last question, quote, "If Ukraine and its Western supporters lose resolve, Europe may face a scenario where Russia subjugates the rest of Ukraine, installs a puppet regime, and gradually integrates most or all of the country into a new Russian empire. In the long term, it would be a Pyrrhic victory for Moscow. The repressive empire would struggle to digest its occupied lands, subdue a restive population, and bear the burden of very high military expenditures in a new war of confrontation," unquote. But in the meantime, Bild writes, tens of millions of Ukrainians will have fled westward, and NATO and Russia will be facing off in a battle that could escalate to the nuclear level. You would also think that public opinion in either Ukraine or Russia might shift against further fighting, but there is no evidence that that is happening. Ukraine is drafting men of all ages, perhaps a sign that it is running low on new recruits, and those in the army are having to serve multiple tours of duty. Yet we see few reports of public disaffection. In Russia, reliable opinion polls show increasing support for the war, 77% compared with 7% who are opposed. Pride in Russia is rising even as fear about a bigger war is also prominent. What all this information tells us is that both governments are controlling the narrative of a glorious and necessary war with no end in sight. Who will be France's prime minister? With the Olympic Games just days away, France remains without a prime minister. President Emmanuel Macron is playing the naming of a prime minister close to the vest. He has to consider whether to go leftward with the new Popular Front alliance, which won the most seats in the National Assembly, or rightward with Marine Le Pen's National Rally. For now, though, Macron has shown he's not out of cards to play just yet. First, he designated Gabriel Attal, the current prime minister and a centrist, to stay on temporarily, which could turn out to be quite a while. Second, a centrist loyal to Macron won election to serve a second term as president or speaker of the National Assembly. The left has not helped matters. Their four constituents, the Greens, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, and France Unbowed, are squabbling and seemingly unable to unite behind a candidate for the prime ministership. In fact, the left seems to be reenacting its traditional role as an opposition party. As one of the Left Alliance's leaders, Marine Tondelier of the Greens, said, quote, "We have to be a government of combat, a government of action, of social justice. It won't be simple, easy, evident, or comfortable, but we must make the effort, unquote. As for the internal bickering on the left, she says, quote, I am angry, disgusted, and fed up, and I feel desperate at the spectacle we are offering to the French people. The two-state solution in the Middle East may be dead. Just days before Prime Minister Netanyahu's arrival in the United States, the Israeli Knesset, or parliament, passed a resolution opposing the two-state solution. 68 members of the Knesset, led by Netanyahu's coalition and the far right, voted in favor. Benny Gantz and his party, supposedly the opposition, also voted in favor. Only 9 members of the Knesset, all on the left, voted against. This is the first time in history that the Knesset passed a resolution that unequivocally denies the possibility of two states, regardless of negotiations on the future of the occupied territories. The resolution says in part, quote, the establishment of a Palestinian state in the heart of the land of Israel will pose an existential danger to the state of Israel and its citizens, perpetuate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and destabilize the region. It will only be a matter of time until Hamas takes over the Palestinian state and turns it into a radical Islamic terror base, working in coordination with the Iranian-led Axis to eliminate the state of Israel, unquote. To Palestinians, the vote only confirms what they have long believed and what recent Israeli actions in the West Bank have confirmed, that Israel will never permit establishment of a Palestinian state or elections to determine one, and that Hamas is legitimized and strengthened every time Israel demonstrates its opposition to an independent Palestinian state. As one Palestinian writes, quote, I always tell diplomats and policymakers, if you don't like Hamas's rising popularity, then prove them wrong. Show us that diplomacy works, that international law matters, that the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice can hold Israel to account, that you can pressure Israel to end the occupation and accept peace, that our nonviolent resistance will be supported and amplified by your governments. Only then would you see a decrease in the support for armed resistance when there's a genuine way toward progress, unquote. The International Criminal Court weighed in July 19, saying Israel should end the occupation of Palestinian territory, cease establishing new settlements and evacuate existing ones, and pay reparations to Palestinians who have been deprived of their property. The court advised that governments refuse to recognize Israel's occupation. Israel refused to take part in the proceedings, saying they are, quote, an abuse of international law and the judicial process. The Jewish people are not conquerors in their own land, said Netanyahu. The legality of the settlements, he said, cannot be contested. The International Court of Justice's decision is advisory, but it adds to the pressure on Israel to reach a settlement with Hamas that not only creates a ceasefire, but also stops the process of officially absorbing the West Bank. In other news, protests and violence in Kenya. Kenya's young people are leading the way in calling for the ouster of President William Ruto. As reported from Kenya, protests are over, quote, anger at the government's plan to increase taxes while social services collapsed, public university fees soared, and an unemployment crisis deepened. Even as the street action has faded, more Kenyans are now openly following graft cases on social media, circulating excerpts from the Constitution, and calling and texting legislators, unquote. President Ruto is responding by retreating to his home and sacking some cabinet members. But given his background, he is a protege of Daniel Arap Moi, the dictator who ruled Kenya between 1978 and 2002. He was indicted by the International Criminal Court for his part in violently suppressing protesters in 2007, and his administration has been marked by graft and defiance of the country's constitution. It doesn't seem likely he will win over the crowds. These latest taxes on ordinary goods are an attempt to increase government revenue in response to the demands of the International Monetary Fund, to which Kenya is deeply in debt. But the taxes wouldn't be necessary if official corruption were addressed. Ruto is promising to do that, but in the meantime, people are being arbitrarily arrested and beaten. A presidential election in Venezuela holds prospect of change. Venezuela holds a presidential election July 28, in which the opposition has a substantial lead in opinion polls. the usually fractured opposition has united behind a single presidential candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez, who has been leading the polls by over 20 points. Two-thirds of registered voters are planning to cast their ballots this month, compared with 46% who turned out for the 2018 presidential election. If Gonzalez wins and President Nicolas Maduro steps down, his administration and the military elite face a host of criminal charges, including from the U.S. Justice Department and the International Criminal Court. In such circumstances, I anticipate the U.S. will do what it has done with dictators in the past, offer Maduro a comfortable exit by dropping all charges. Since the U.S. has held talks with Maduro, the opportunity for a deal is there. With Maduro gone, the U.S. can end sanctions on Venezuela and help its economy to get back on track. But again, all this depends on Maduro and the Venezuelan military allowing a free election to take place. If he refuses to step down, expect a new surge of outbound migration and new problems for the U.S. at the Mexico border. In closing, some news briefs. First, Russia convicts reporter Evan Gershkovich. The expected conviction of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich on espionage charges came to pass July 19. He will have to serve 16 years in a maximum security penal colony unless a prisoner exchange can be worked out with Russia. He has been in prison since March 2023. The trial took place in secret, and evidence against Gershkovich was kept from his lawyers. President Biden and the Wall Street Journal refer to him as a hostage. Next, the Philippines and China reach agreement to ease conflict. Tensions over a contested shoal in the South China Sea have eased thanks to an agreement between the two countries that allows the Philippines to resupply soldiers on an old boat that symbolizes its claim. It's a victory of sorts for the Philippines, since the Chinese have backed their claims with heavily armed Coast Guard vessels that have harassed Filipino supply ships. And finally, on global warming, temperatures in the Persian Gulf reached 144, or over 60 degrees centigrade, a life-threatening figure. If the heat index, which factors in humidity, is counted, temperatures are closer to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Last year at this time, if you can believe it, the heat index in the Gulf area was 158. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I had the great pleasure of interviewing writer Kai Emmons five times for KBOO before she ended her life in January 2023 through Oregon's Death with Dignity program. Kai was diagnosed with bulbar onset ALS in early 2021 at the age of 70. It's a debilitating disease which takes away the power of speech before affecting the rest of the body. And for now, at least, there is no cure. Always a strong and independent woman, Kai made the decision to end her life on her own terms. Kai lives on in her books, as well as our memories and our hearts. It was a remarkable life, and there will soon be a documentary film titled Vanishing, a love story recounting the last 6 months of that remarkable life. The filmmaker Sandra Luco, who was handpicked by Kai, is in Portland this week for two screenings of the work in progress, part of a fundraising campaign to complete the film. We're fortunate to have Sandra with us now to talk about Kai, the film, and the screenings. Well, Sandra, welcome back to Oregon, your home state.
Thank you very much. It is such a pleasure to be here for this particular event.
Well, you're both a filmmaker and a teacher of film production at Yale, Columbia, and Barnard, and you grew up here in Oregon. Your first film was the documentary Sharp Edges, about a childhood friend who went on to some degree of celebrity, some would say notoriety.
That's correct. My first film was about the first national figure skating competition of Tonya Harding, which was back in New York. And this was when she was age 15. And I had skated with her. We had the same coach. And the film itself became the basis for the movie I, Tonya.
And you also made the 2018 documentary, That Way Madness Lies, which we actually did a KABU interview for that when you had a screening for your brother, Dwayne. It was his 60th birthday. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 46. And I think that film was the work that caught Kai's attention and had her thinking that you were the right person for the project.
Yes. Well, Kai and I had met through a Yale University function of women at Yale. She was from the first graduating class of women at Yale. And I had done a presentation there about women who had been involved with film. And we had met over Zoom. And it was at the height of the pandemic. And so we would have about maybe once every 2 weeks or once every 3 weeks, we would have a quarantini meeting. And we would talk, and we would talk about art and life and philosophy and storytelling for hours on end. And then she had said to me that she really wanted to not do these quarantinis anymore because there was something wrong with her voice. And I said, Kai, is it because we talk for 4 hours at a time and have several cocktails? It happens to the best of us. And she said, no, it's something much more serious than that. And about 6 months after that, she got the ALS diagnosis.
That ALS is called bulbar onset, and that kind of takes your voice before affecting the rest of the body. So that's where the symptoms were coming from. She was losing her ability to speak.
Yes, she did lose her ability to speak really quite rapidly after the diagnosis. And ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, as it is also known, seems to attack people's strengths. And so for her, she was a communicator, she was a storyteller, she was this writer, and it was her voice that was the first thing to go. But she did see the movie about my brother, and she saw how directly confrontational I was with the issue of mental illness. And when we decided that we were going to make a film about the last 6 months of her life, she made me promise that I would confront whatever she confronted with the same sort of openness and honesty and approach it, which would include shooting her death with dignity.
There was a connection between you also, because I think you both studied film at Yale, though several years apart, and you both received MFAs from NYU, the Tisch School of Arts and Filmmaking. Sandra, were you already aware of any of Kai's work as a screenwriter and also as a novelist?
Well, this is the way I like to introduce Kai. As I say, Kai and I have so much in common. She lives in Oregon. I grew up in Oregon. She grew up on the East Coast. I now live on the East Coast. Kai went to Yale. I went to Yale. Kai graduated summa cum laude. I did not. We both went to NYU Film School. Kai won a Student Academy Award. I did not.
Now, when you first started working with her, and she was able to speak, you had those quarantinis that you said, she was kind of almost challenging you to kind of match her courage and her bravery, which I've known her for a few years before she died. We did several interviews, and you know, it was just evident in her, that strength and that persistence. Now, one of your film professors at Yale, Annette Insdorf, she's now a teaching colleague of yours, I think, at Columbia. She praised your ability to examine on film, quote, the fragility and resiliency of the human spirit. And I can't think of any story more attuned to that than Kai's story, her resiliency, but also her fragility in the face of the ALS diagnosis.
Absolutely. But it's interesting. There was physical fragility from Kai, but there was absolutely not any sort of mental fragility. She was very clear.
Oh no, I didn't mean to imply that. No, definitely, because I interviewed her even when she wasn't able to speak. She was using a text-to-voice device, and you could tell that everything up there was just perfect.
Absolutely, and she liked provoking people. It was a great challenge for me as a filmmaker because she was the one who had the agency in this film. She provoked me at every turn. She gave me a shot list every morning when we, you know, because we actually did not meet in person until the day that I started filming, which was almost exactly 2 years ago. And she was constantly, we had made constantly, she got permissions from people. She demanded that her friends and family confront this issue of her ALS and the meaning of her life very profoundly and openly. And they really rose to the occasion, and everybody opened themselves up for this film to be made.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about her resiliency, because I mean, it's almost her superhuman strength for Kai. She went kayaking during those last months before she passed, and also took two guided trips on psilocybin mushrooms. Did you film those events? I know she wrote about that in her blog.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you know, one of the things that was really important for both of us in making this film is that we wanted to show that despite the fact that her body was disintegrating, her mind was completely and totally there. And she was very much a part of the world, very politically active. As a matter of fact, the first time that I met her, I was coming over to the house, and she said, or Paul said to me, please come to have dinner with us, but please arrive either before 6 p.m. or after 6:20, because Kai does not like to miss the A block of the Rachel Maddow show. And so, I mean, and literally my first day in there, I met them, I gave them a hug, we sat down, and with a cocktail, we watched Rachel Maddow, which we did almost every night that I was there, you know, there filming. She was somebody who was very important to her, for people to understand that she wasn't, her whole was not the sum of her deteriorating parts. And so even though she couldn't speak, one of the things we worked very hard at was how do we get the lyrical, expressive, articulate Kai to be present in the film when she was so controlled by the limitations of the machines in front of her. And we ended up finding a company in the Ukraine, which was kind of amazing, because when I drove up into her driveway for the first time, she had the Ukrainian flag hanging out in solidarity. We found a company called ReSpeecher, which literally does a technology called voice-to-voice technology. And her voice has been created for her to posthumously narrate the film, and it is her voice.
Oh, it's amazing. In fact, you sent me a link to a 4-minute trailer where you could hear Kai's synthesized voice through ReSpeecher. And I played back an interview I did when she was able to speak. I think that was like 6 years ago or 5 years ago. Anyways, for her novel, Weather Woman. And it's just uncanny, the similarity.
Right. So there are two voices that you hear in that trailer. You hear the voice of her machine that she typed on, which is called the text-to-voice. And then the voice-to-voice, and actually you helped me out with this, Ken, is that you let me have access to one of the recordings. We sent that over to the Ukraine, where the AI technology learns her voice, and then we have an actor read from her blog, and that voice gets converted into Kai's voice.
Oh, that's how it's done. Yeah, that was the part that I listened to when she was reading from her blog post that she wrote in those last 6 months before she took her life. Now, I want to get to the title, Sandra. It's Vanishing, and that was also the title of Kai's book of short fiction, which came out in 2020, and a theme of much of her work. Why did you pick that title for your film? I just gave the answer there.
Well, because Kai vanishes from us. Kai vanishes from us, but she's not really gone. And it's really called Vanishing, semicolon, a love story, and a love story is ALS.
Right. And the love story, you mentioned her husband, Paul, who was just amazing to Kai, to you, and also to me when we did those last few interviews where she was using the text-to-voice device. That's a big part of the love story there. What was his role in helping get the film made?
Paul absolutely did everything that Kai asked of him in terms of being present in the film, in terms of showing how the caretaking happened. But then after Kai had passed, he has supplied me with photographs. He has supplied me with old 8mm film, family films of Kai. He is the associate producer on the film, and he has been just a tremendous partner and a very brave partner and participant in the film.
And he'll be there at the screenings tomorrow and on Monday?
Yes. So we're going to have two screenings. One is at the Mission Theater. It's free for everyone who wants to come. It's a fundraising screening. We still have about $100,000 that we need to get the film finished. What you will see is very much, I mean, it's a lot of the technical stuff that needs to happen that doesn't really sort of appear on the screen is where a lot of that money's going. And then the second screening is going to be on Monday evening at 7 p.m. at the Living Room Theater. And that you do have to make go online and make reservations for. And there's a, I think it's a $13 ticket charge.
And that's a much smaller theater than the Mission. So
yeah, the Mission I can have over 100 people. And the other theater, the Living Room Theater, is 61.
Now, in the publicity for the screenings, you quote Kaya saying, "This isn't going to be a grim film, I promise." That must have been a challenge to portray the joy of her last months amid the tragedy of her illness and kind of her body failing her and her death.
It wasn't. And that's all Kai. Kai was determined that we don't need to look at this tragically. And really, ALS and the death with dignity they're the antagonists of the film. But this is about how a woman chose to live in the face of coming, you know, to, I mean, you even see in the trailer, you even see that, I mean, she's for energy, she's still injecting into her feeding tube her daily Dutch Brothers coffee.
Oh, right. That was in the trailer.
Yeah.
Oh, I noticed that.
And if one of the founders of Dutch Brothers actually passed away from ALS. And so if anybody has any connections, how I can get in touch with the other brother, Travis, to see the film, that is something I really, really want to make happen.
How can listeners, people who support the film, want to see it finished and released, but we can't attend the screenings? How can we help?
I think the best way to do is to go to our website, which is www.vanishingalovestory.com. And there is a link to the